How are you?
Hey, Laurie. How you doing?
I'm doing good.
Things calming down?
So far.
All right. That's a good thing. Michelle, are you on the phone? Not yet.
Howard?
Hey, Mike, how are you?
Good. How are you, my friend?
Doing well, thank you.
How's the knee?
Coming along. Finished physical therapy.
Nice.
Yeah. So, ready to start playing golf.
I thought you'd be doing the turkey trot on Thanksgiving Day.
I think I'll forego that.
I did that one year.
Did you really?
Yeah, it was nice. I did the one down in my old stomping grounds down off in Northern District.
Uh-huh.
It was nice. Went around Drew's Hill Lake, or Drew Park Lake. It was a good time.
I assume it all depends on the weather. If the weather's nice, it's a good thing. If it's cold, it's not so nice.
Yeah, it was nice. But, I mean, if I remember correctly, it was kind of windy, so you had to make sure you, at least in my case, I had to have a hat on. But, no, it was a good time, and I did it with three of my kids, so that was a lot of fun.
That makes it special.
Yeah.
Good morning, Howard. It's Ann.
Hey, Ann. How you doing?
Good. How you doing?
Good. You know, I was watching the debates last night.
Oh, yeah.
I came to the conclusion, whether you're a Republican or Democrat, that these debates on either side would be much better if they didn't have live crowds.
Oh, I agree.
I find the crowds to be distracting. I think the participants play to the live crowds instead of playing to the people out in the general TV audience. I just find it annoying on either side.
Yeah.
It reminds me of like these Jerry Springer shows, you know, where you say,
yeah.
I believe in the apple pie and the American way of life and everybody's applauding, blah, blah, blah. I just wish they wouldn't have live crowds, honestly.
Yeah, it would be helpful to end those, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but it'll never happen.
Right.
It'll never happen. So we got about another minute. My guess is some people may not be on today because of Veterans Day. But we'll see.
Is it just me and Ann?
No, I think there are others on. Okay, it's 9:02 by my clock, and we'll get started. Michelle, can you put this on mute, please, if you're out there? You may not be out there. Okay, we'll get started. Lots to talk about today. As usual, being as though it's the second Wednesday in November. Kind of hard to believe that Thanksgiving is almost upon us. So, first, found it interesting, on November the 2nd, President Obama gave a speech at one of the Newark campus of the Rutgers Law School. And in that speech, he made a proposal and continued to push for national ban-the-box legislation. And we've talked about in prior telebriefs, ban-the-box legislation on local and state levels. But this was a pretty overt response by the president. And what he said was that, in quotes, he says, like a lot of big employers, the federal government should not, I believe, screen out applicants simply because of a mistake they made in the past. He said some really good, really successful companies are already doing this, naming Walmart, Target, and Home Depot. And he went on to say that there are 600,000 inmates released from incarceration each year, while 70 million citizens have some degree of criminal record. He went on to propose in sort of a peripheral way, he said he announced the creation of what he called a national clean slate clearinghouse where the Labor and Justice Departments would aid legal aid programs and public defenders and reentry programs with providing expungement and other legal services. So clearly, both at the local level and at the state level, we see a major move afoot regarding ban-the-box legislation. I'd also point out that there was an article on Corporate Counsel, which is on the an internet publication that I get, very recently, where they talked about the interplay between those individuals who may be applying for jobs with criminal records and those with disabilities. And often the two intersect because many people who have criminal records also have some sort of mental disability. And so they quote a little bit about a woman named Marcia Temple of Los Angeles Integrated Recovery Network, says, knows full well the stories of many of the individuals for whom the box is a major barrier. For more than 15 years, she has worked to improve mental health services for people who are homeless and or have mental health disorders, about 44% of whom have spent time in jail, prison, or community corrections. And as the article explains, in California alone, there are about 33,000 prisoners with mental health disorders, roughly 30% of the incarcerated population. So this is an issue that is not going away anytime soon. I think that all of you out there need to investigate what your processes are, because, as you know, in prior telebriefs, I've talked about the EEOC's position, even in the absence of ban-the-box legislation, on the consideration of criminal backgrounds vis-a-vis hiring decisions. And what the EEOC has said, and I know I've covered this before, but I think it bears repeating, is that decisions when it comes to individuals with possible criminal backgrounds should be made on an individualistic background. That a bright line policy of never hiring an individual with a criminal background is probably not going to suffice or pass muster under the EEOC's latest guidance, certainly not under local or state level ban-the-box legislation. Where federal legislation is enacted at some point in the near future, it won't pass muster there. Does that mean that you as an employer have no ability to, in effect, consider criminal backgrounds of individuals? The answer clearly is no, that you can consider it, but there's got to be an individualistic determination which assesses how long ago did this criminal conviction occur. Obviously, if it was in the last 6 months or a year, it's a lot more relevant than a conviction that may have happened 20 years ago. Secondly, what's the nature of the particular conviction? Is a conviction for drug possession, which is fairly mundane in today's world, as opposed to a conviction for a violent offense, or an offense where the individual was convicted of fraud or embezzlement, and you know that that person may have access to money or other kinds of sensitive financial data or proprietary information. So you look at when did it occur, what was the nature of the offense. Thirdly, look at the connection between the offense and the job for which that person may be applying. Obviously, some criminal convictions may have little relevance to a particular job that the person may be applying for. So you still have, in my opinion, and I've been asked this by many clients, wide discretion in determining whether or not you're going to hire somebody. But I would advise you that if you make your decision not to hire on the basis of a criminal conviction, that you document your decision and the reasons why. Because if you're challenged down the road, you don't want to be fumbling around trying to figure out what it is I did or didn't do in terms of due diligence with regard to a particular individual. Also, with regard to criminal convictions, I stress the word conviction because arrest really cannot be considered under clear EEOC guidance as to whether or not you're going to allow the applicant to be further considered for employment. It's convictions, and it's not something that is a mere arrest, because, as you know, the theory is that disproportionately minorities and other protected classifications are arrested much more often than unprotected employees. So we're constantly bombarded with issues in connection with this, and it's not an issue that's gone away. So I think that based on what President Obama has said, and certainly if there's a Democrat who is elected into the White House in 2016, this will be no less of an initiative of that president than it is with this particular president. So be wise and use your discretion and use your due diligence in a very careful way. And by the way, there's nothing that would preclude you from talking to an applicant's attorney to get more information about a particular conviction. I know that I've done that many times on behalf of clients, and most times if the attorneys know that the client is being seriously considered for a job, they'll be forthright in giving you information. Okay, let's move on. I wanted to mention that a few weeks ago, on Monday, October 19th, the OFCCP, which is the Office of Federal Contracting Compliance Programs, published it on its website, and you can go on its website, a sort of pocket card that they invite employees to use, which is called Requesting a Reasonable Accommodation. The intention of which was articulated as helping employees identify what they need to do in requesting an accommodation for a disability when applying for a job or a job transfer or promotion. Some of which is, I think, fine, some of which is questionable because of its omissions, and I'll review these with you because I think they are instructive in certain respects. So the card, if you go on the OFCCP website, will have the following subparts. So number one is, what is a reasonable accommodation? OFCCP instructs employees or applicants that it is an adjustment or modification made to a job or the workplace or the usual manner or circumstances of performing the job that allows an applicant or employee with a disability to successfully apply for the job, perform the duties of the job, or enjoy the benefits and privileges of employment. Reasonable accommodation also applies to the application process. I think that that's fine. I don't have any problem really with that part of the card. The second part of this instructive piece says, how do I request a reasonable accommodation? And here the OFCP says, typically just ask. There is no special process to request an accommodation and you do not have to use special words, nor do you have to put your request in writing. However, some contractors do have a specific process to ask your employer. What I find wanting and deficient about this is the instruction that you don't need any specific words to request an accommodation. Clearly, I think that if you want a situation where the applicant or employee is not talking past the employer, I do think it helps when the employer or applicant says specifically to the employer, I need an accommodation to do this particular job. Thirdly, what do I need to tell my employer? The OFCCP instructs, simply tell your employer that you need an adjustment or change at work due to your disability. Be prepared to provide your employer with enough information to show that you have a disability. It is important to note that you are not required to provide your entire medical or mental health history to obtain an accommodation. You only need to provide pertinent information to request an accommodation. That clearly, in my mind, is insufficient to satisfy the legal requirements, because employers always have a right to make further inquiries in order to get further medical substantiation to show, A, that the applicant or employee has, in fact, a disability, and, B, a medical opinion as to what, if any, real accommodation needs to be made in order for that employee or applicant to do the essential functions of a particular job. So I don't believe the OFCCP has really accurately stated that particular obligation on the part of the employee. The fourth part of its little card says, what happens next? After the request is made, the employer may ask that you complete certain forms or follow other procedures. Any procedures you are asked to follow cannot be used to prevent a timely accommodation from being provided or addressed. Now, of course, this doesn't say that just because you ask for an accommodation that one will be granted. As we all know, the employer has to weigh the administrative and financial burdens on the organization with a specific request made by the employee. And if there's an undue burden which is placed upon the employer, that the employer is under no obligation to accept the employee's suggested accommodation. They do list in here the various types of accommodations that frequently can be made. These are also listed in the EEOC's guidelines, but these are providing written materials in accessible formats, such as large print, braille, etc., adjusting or modifying work schedules, providing readers or sign language interpreters, holding recruitment interviews, tests, and other parts of the application process in accessible locations, holding staff meetings in accessible locations, providing or modifying equipment and devices, adjusting or modifying policies and procedures, changing the work environment in ways that improve accessibility. The last slide, so to speak, or card on this, is that they say if you believe you have experienced discrimination, contact the OFCCP, and they give the OFCCP's number. They really don't mention in here the process by which there should be an interchange, in other words, an interactive process between the employer and the employee, which, of course, is really the critical component of any of this discussion on the accommodation of any kind of disabilities. Significantly, the OFCCP does not indicate that it's the employer's duty to give this card, for want of a better word, to employees. So it's not like the employer has Miranda warnings written on a little card when it comes to disability, and it has to provide these warnings to an employee. The last thing I want to talk about this morning, I had a question from one of the people that was listening to a prior telebrief about wage and hour audits and the preparation for a wage and hour audit, either internally conducted or by the Wage and Hour Division of the Department of Labor. And I thought I would spend a couple minutes going over some details about what I think it is that you need to do, whether you're doing your own internal investigation or hopefully not subject to a DOL investigation or audit. So I know that we've talked about this before, but certainly you should check all of your current 1099 relationships and vendor agreements to make sure that you are paying people as independent contractors appropriately as opposed to employees, which is a subject in and of itself. But suffice it to say, that's an essential part of the audit. I think that you need to investigate very closely your written job descriptions to make sure that they really do accurately reflect the work that's being done pursuant to each of those job descriptions, that they've been updated periodically when necessary, and that if you have exempt positions with exempt job descriptions, that you would feel comfortable presenting those job descriptions to the Department of Labor in order to confirm or corroborate your contention that they are indeed exempt positions. I think you need to review your timekeeping systems to make sure that your non-exempt employees are indeed being accurately paid for all time worked. That includes, you know, pre-shift work, post-shift work, and even lunch periods or meal periods if they are not being relieved of their particular duties during the meal period. That under the DOL rules and regs, you are entitled to round, but you know you can't round to 20 minutes. Really, in my opinion, 12 to 15 is the outside limit, so you need to make sure that you're not rounding down or up more than that as you keep time for your non-exempt employees. Payroll records should be checked to make sure that they're accurate, current, and obviously reflect all hours worked on a weekly basis by your, particularly your non-exempt employees. Obviously, you need an accurate timekeeping system, and you really should have a system by which employees who are complaining in any particular pay period that they haven't been paid correctly have an avenue by which they can raise those questions. Because obviously, in your handbook, it would be helpful to say that employees who believe that they have been paid inappropriately in any pay period or any pay week have a particular procedure to follow, so that if the DOL is dealing with a claim of unpaid overtime, for instance, over a long period of time, you can point to provisions in your handbook which impose obligations on employees to raise these issues on a timely basis in order that they can be remedied. I think that you need to educate your supervisors and managers on the appropriate timekeeping systems that you have, on the need to make sure that employees are being paid for all time worked, and certainly that you want to make sure that you are exempt employees, those employees that you are counting as exempt employees, are not having their salaries deducted for inappropriate reasons. There are some reasons that you simply cannot deduct from an exempt employee without impairing the exemption of that employee. That is, they need to be paid the same salary on a weekly basis, irrespective of the quality or quantity of their work. And so if you have an exempt employee who is just a crappy performer, you need to address that by virtue of a performance evaluation or discipline, but not by docking that particular exempt employee. So, you know, these are things that you can do prophylactically. As I've said before, if you're conducting a internal wage and hour audit, the smartest thing to do is to have it done in conjunction with your employment attorney so that communications will be shielded by either the attorney-client communication privilege or the attorney work product privilege, either of which or both of which may be applicable. And in the unfortunate situation, of course, where you are randomly audited by the DOL or the DOL responds to a particular employee complaint or an ex-employee complaint, all of those particular things will be appropriate, but there will be a lot more that you'll need to do in conjunction with your employment attorney, including attending an opening conference with the DOL, making sure that there's a good flow of information and a careful flow of information with the DOL, and making sure that all communications really are herded through and processed through your employment attorney so as to protect those communications by virtue of the attorney-client privilege. So I know I stressed this before, that wage and hour audits are a good thing prophylactically to do because of the real activism of the Department of Labor that's going on now. We see it in our firm with many, many clients, and I don't think that it's going to decrease dramatically anytime soon. I really believe that the Department of Labor is using whatever power it has and whatever resources it has to come after companies, and when they come after companies, they very seldom leave without finding some sort of deficiency. So it behooves you to act in a proactive way prior to the DOL's either showing up at your doorstep. By the way, they have no right to appear and to come into your place of business without a warrant. Whether you choose to allow them to come in is up to you. But usually what happens is you can arrange within 72 hours or more for them to show up if they need to show up. So those are the developments for the day. As always, I take whatever questions you have, comments you have, and if you want to do it in private, as I always indicate, feel free to email me at hkerman@offakerman.com or my private personal firm line, which is 410-209-6417. Any questions or comments?
Howard?
Yes.
This is Lori. I just have one quick question because it's come up a couple times in the past month or two. Are you allowed to actually come out and ask a candidate who is applying for a position if they're a U.S. citizen?
No. No.
Okay,
you,
because we have
now, if you're filling government jobs where that is a requirement because of security and all, that's different. But generally, the answer to that is no. That, you know, it goes really to the I-9 issue, which is they have to be able to present evidence that they have the ability to work in the United States, but that doesn't necessarily entail citizenship.
Because we have a client who requires a federal background check.
That's different.
So
that's different.
Okay.
Yeah, that's different in the public sector. Any other questions? Yeah, I'm sorry, Lori.
No, it's okay. They are a public company, but because they're a bank, so they require that all of their people are.
Yeah, again, statutorily, there are many financial regulations and such that do require it. So you just have to, you know, it depends on where in the queue you're dealing with. Any other questions? Okay. Well, our next telebrief, I guess, will be the day before Thanksgiving, Wednesday, November the 25th. And I wish you all a good next 2 weeks, and we'll talk soon.
Thanks, Howard.
Thanks. Okay. Thank you, Howard.
Thanks a lot.
Bye.